This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. It's the economy, stupid. Now, historians think that that phrase sealed Bill Clinton's 1992 victory against then-President George H.W. Bush. Well, the question has not become any less important since. The economy is the single most important issue of this election as well. But the language has gotten a little more complicated.
National debt.
Debt piling on debt.
Finding offsetting costs.
Cut federal spending.
Massive recession.
Balanced budget amendment.
$1 trillion deficit.
Debt limit.
Pare down that deficit.
$4 trillion of deficits.
Get that debt under control.
Debt, deficit. President Barack Obama, Mitt Romney are fluent in the language of economics, but are you? Here to help us is Patty Hirsch, senior producer of Marketplace Money and Marketplace's Whiteboard Guru. He's got a new book called Man Versus Markets, and he joins us in the studio now. Patty, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this business of debt. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm in debt. I have a mortgage. Mm-hmm. I'm not a bad man. Nobody's telling me to stop being in debt. What's the difference between my personal debt and this debt that everybody thinks is so evil out there?
Well, it's not much. And I'm actually, you know, it's like we have this enormous mortgage because we've got to get things done. We've got to spend. And just like a company takes out a big loan in order to, I don't know, buy another company or, you know, to expand its operations. So America is taking out loans in order to expand their operations, whether they be in Afghanistan or whether they be, you know, trying to, you know, push themselves in terms of their growth at home or their growth overseas. It's kind of exactly the same thing. So, you know, debt is not necessarily evil, although there is quite a lot of it in this case.
And it costs. So there is, I mean, if I was carrying a big credit card balance at 18-21%, for mm-hmm. instance, that'd be rough on me and perhaps my children.
Yes, that would be rough on you. Fortunately for us, we're carrying it at a rather low rate. In fact, it would be very, very difficult for us to borrow much more cheaply than we are. And here's the thing, you know, if you can borrow cheaply and you need to borrow, then borrow, right? But just make sure you have a plan to pay it back. And I think that's what's really kind of lurking behind people's heads here is that, you know, it's one thing for us to borrow. And, you know, America has always borrowed and most countries do borrow. But the question is, do we have a plan to pay it back? And I think that that's really what's kind of freaking people out when they see the size of this $1 trillion or $16 trillion of debt that we have.
And what's the difference between debt and deficit?
All right. So the deficit is the difference between what's coming in the door and what's going out the door. It's like in your house, for example, you have a certain number of expenditures during the year, you know, and they may be, let's just say, for example, it's $1 million because you're very wealthy. So you spend $1 million during the year. OK, the deficit is whether or not you're spending more than you have coming in the door. So if you're earning only $500,000 a year and you're spending $1 million a year, then you've got a huge deficit. It's a $500,000 deficit, right? We could, of course, have a surplus. You could earn $1.5 million a year and then spend $1 million, in which case you've got a surplus, which is, of course, what we had, you know, during the Clinton administration. But now because of, you know, the Bush tax cuts and the various wars and, you know, the fact that we've had a recession and we've had to spend our way out of it, or certainly the government has decided we have to spend our way out of it, we've now got this, you know, enormous deficit where we're spending way, way more than we are actually earning.
And how is that not a debt? What when I talk about the national debt, that's different.
Well, the debt is actually the amount of money that we owe. You know, so and usually that's expressed in terms of, you know, debt as a ratio, debt to gross domestic product. So the amount of money that we earn in a year is, say, $15 trillion at this point. But the amount that we owe right now, the amount of outstanding debt that we have, is $16 trillion. So we have, you know, it's almost like 100% is our ratio, which is not good. But at the same time, that debt is very, very inexpensive. As I said before, it's cheap debt. So long as we are able to service it all the time, you know, that's what people are worried about. Are we able to keep paying those interest payments? As long as we can do that, as long as we have a plan to pay that off, we don't want to be holding it forever, then, you know, it's not so bad. It means our credit rating won't go down, and it means that our borrowing costs won't go up. And that's really what we're aimed at doing.
And in some ways, we owe it to ourselves, don't we? How much of this money is this debt is held by others and makes us vulnerable? And how much of it is just a kind of a, you know, sort of on paper?
Absolutely. The majority of that debt is held by Americans. I mean, we owe it to ourselves. We buy our own debt. And that's always been the case, actually, in the United States. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, us being in hock to China. Certainly, we do owe China a lot of money, but we owe ourselves more. So we're really sort of fueling our own debt because we're such a good credit risk. I mean, everybody in America believes that America is a great credit risk because, you know, it's still the largest manufacturing economy in the world. We still make a lot of goods. We're still very successful. We have a great workforce. So people are investing in their own country, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Which is, in a sense, a vote of confidence. If you can issue these bonds, and that's kind of how we do it, right? We mm-hmm. say, all right, I'll tell you what, I will, would you lend me this much money? I'll pay you that plus interest. Mm-hmm. So you don't get an equity stake in the country.
Right.
You can't own part of it, but we will pay you back with interest. Mm-hmm. People are buying those. They say, well, it's a good country. And by the way, you make it too big to fail.
The one necessarily doesn't go on top of the other one, but that's right. absolutely right. You know, people around the world look at America and say, these people in America, these men and women who work so hard, you know, have such a great country, a great system, you know, great entrepreneurship. They're voting on America. They're saying America is a great bet. We're not even going to ask for very much interest. In fact, in some cases, we're going to even almost pay to lend to America. But that's how much they trust us.
All right, Patty Hirsch. So your book is called Man Versus Markets, Plural. When we talk now about the way money is invested, the way finance works, finance capital goes out there in the big wide world, it looks for its best return, and then things happen. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. A factory opens, people are put to work, mm-hmm. and products that we absolutely need, like iPhone 5, are invented, mm-hmm. and I own it.
Right.
And that's how capitalism works, I think, in a nutshell.
Well, that's pretty much it. Yeah, you know, you're investing money in companies that are going to grow, whether you be investing them through the debt markets, through buying bonds or by senior secured loans, which you can do these days, or by investing through stocks and shares, which is what, you know, most people think about when they talk about the market. They talk about the stock market. But of course, there are a whole variety of markets. You can invest in the futures market, the commodities markets, all this kind of stuff. But really, when you're investing in companies, you're talking about those two areas, the debt market, the equity market. And the idea of doing that is either to get a regular return back through dividends on stocks or to get paid back, you know, through interest through bonds. But essentially, you're making a bet on a company. You're saying, this company, I think, is going to do well in the medium or short, medium or long term, or however long your investment's going to be. And you're expecting to get paid for that.
In a way, and I'd like to use this framework maybe to try to understand it. If we go back to It's a Wonderful Life, we've got George Bailey. He's got the savings and loan. He's investing in his community, pennies at a time. Nickels at a time, they buy the house and people put a little bit away and a community is built. Then we got old Mr. Potter over there, mm-hmm. who says, your nickels and dimes aren't going to get you anywhere. You want to grow fast, Bailey, you got to do it my way. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between, say, these equity investments in which I own a part of the company and I want the value to go up, mm-hmm. any which way you can, mm-hmm. and a bond in which, well, I get an interest rate and it's pretty much guaranteed, but I don't own the company, so up or down doesn't much matter.
Absolutely. What you're talking about there is your evaluation of risk. All right. So if you invest in the stock market, it's risky. If you buy an individual share, it's a risky thing because, you know, if the company goes bust, you're done, you know, or if the company does poorly, then that stock is going to drop. All right. So that you're taking a risk. The upside, of course, is that there's no limit to the height that a stock could rise. I mean, if you bought, you know, Apple 20 years ago, you know, the stock was trading at whatever, $6. Look at it now. It's insane. So, you know, you've got this wild sort of multiplication that you can get in equities. But the risk is, of course, that it can go down sharply and the price can go to zero. With a bond, there's much less risk, okay, depending on where you are in the capital structure. You can get a senior bond or a junior bond, you know, and depending on the risk that you're taking, again, if you buy the safest type of bond, you're going to get a smaller interest rate because it's very, very safe. But you're guaranteed that interest rate every single month. And if the company goes bust, well, you're the first one who gets paid out, you know, if they have to sell that company off and divide it all up. There are also these junior bonds that I just talked about, which are a little bit more risky. So therefore, you get a higher interest rate each month. But of course, you're further down the capital structure. So if something goes wrong, you're going to get paid out last after the senior bondholders. But essentially, what you're talking about with a bond, safety. You're guaranteed that interest payment every single month until things go absolutely horrendously bad.
Which means it's slower as well. You're not going to attract as much capital because the possibility of return is smaller, and so I might not get as much money.
Well, exactly, and that's the thing, because with a bond, of course, you're getting paid that set interest rate every month. You can't reach for the sky at that point. It's not like a stock which is going to go through the roof, but at the same time, it's also not going to go through the floor necessarily, or it's very, you'd have to be very unlucky for it to go through the floor. But you're right. I mean, if you're investing that way, your returns are going to be much smaller over a much longer period of time. So it's not like a big break in the way that you could get with a stock.
So I'm interested in the intersection of public policy and mm-hmm. finance capital.
All right.
Because we hear when these two worlds come together that the best thing to do is just leave that world of finance capital alone. If you do, it will generate money that will generate jobs and it will make a better world. Stay away. Don't regulate. Don't overtax. And it'll be a better world. But now I'm looking at these two worlds of risk, higher risk and lower risk, in which I don't really care about the product. All I care about, right, is the mm-hmm. rate of return. Mm-hmm. Which is Las Vegas? If I want to go gamble and make a high rate of return and risk all my money, good place to go. But in terms of that other question, the making a better world, if mm-hmm. only you leave them alone, the money, How does my investing in things that I don't really care about, that I have no stake in the outcome, the product, or what it does, or how it's made, how does that make necessarily a better world? Was there a black box in which one went in, one idea went in, and another idea came out, and they're not really as closely related as some might have us believe?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think in most cases, companies are going to be appealing to investors on a number of levels, right? On the one hand, they're going to be saying, look, we make this great product and we think you should invest in it because it's a fantastic product and it's going to be good for the country or, you know, good for the community or good for you and I, whatever it may be. But then also appealing to people's selfishness, right? And you hear about this this concept of Adam Smith called enlightened self-interest. So they're appealing to people and saying, look, you don't really need to care what it is that we do. All you need to care about is that it's going to work and that you're going to get a return. And so by kind of, you know, combining these two approaches, you know, you're appealing to your greed, but also to appealing to your sense of community. And I think that they're maximizing their ability to attract investment and grow. And I actually don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, a lot of people talk about the need for government to get involved and for government to start sponsoring, you know, companies and in order to grow communities in a certain way or based on a certain agenda. I mean, that sounds like in many ways that's quite a European thing. That's what a lot of European nations look at doing. I think there are some dangers to that because, you know, once you start involving the government too much in the market, then the government becomes a player and then the market becomes skewed. And I think that can be a bit of an issue. It can also dissuade a lot of people from investing because they'll say, well, if the government's going to be investing in this one area, that's clearly where all of the weight is. Maybe I should go into this area too because that's where the growth is going to be. And then it leaves, you know, other companies who happen not to be favored by the government, you know, at a disadvantage. And I think that's a problem.
But the government certainly is involved. The Federal Reserve, there are all kinds of rules, laws, tax laws,
sure,
and the Federal Reserve,
mm-hmm,
that really do play an important part in the way the market works, right?
Absolutely. And I think that this is one of the things that we've seen that's really interesting and that came out of the 2008 financial crisis, is that it showed that the markets over the last sort of 30 years have sort of gone on steroids. I mean, it's kind of like a teenage boy who's now 18 years old, but he's still wearing the same clothes he was when he was 13, right? It's the same way with the regulatory system, because the regulatory system was kind of invented in the 1930s and has sort of been tweaked and updated a little bit on since then, but has also been kind of stripped away and, you know, taken apart by lobbyists in many ways and, you know, it's kind of defunded in some areas and defanged in others. So it's kind of like this teenage boy who's wearing these clothes that he's grown out of. You know, so the seams are bursting, there's rips appearing. Frankly, the financial markets needs a new set of clothes. It doesn't necessarily need more clothes, it doesn't necessarily need more regulation, but it needs better, more simple and more easily understood regulation that people can follow.
Because things have changed a lot. One of the things that have changed, that has changed, is the way in which risk is managed. And again, gets back to the original concept. Markets are a place for competition. The mm-hmm. smartest guys win. And if you take a risk and you lose, hey, you lost.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a derivatives market now that's developed, several markets that have developed to mitigate risk. And that sounds like a good thing on the one hand. On the other, doesn't it sort of change the basic rule? We need to compete. You need to be smart. If you're dumb, you're out.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with mitigating risk, right? I mean, people have been hedging risk for forever. I mean, that's what they do. That's what, you know, farmers, for example, when they buy futures contracts, you know, to lock in a price when they're selling their corn, you know, or airlines when they buy futures contracts to lock in their fuel prices, they do that because they want to make sure that there's no uncertainty for them in the future. They can lock that certainty in. And sometimes it works against them and sometimes it works for them. So, but what we're seeing now is this credit default swap market that you hear about, which is the CDS market, you know, which strikes fear into the heart of most people. And rightly so, because it can be extraordinarily complicated. But essentially what we're talking about here is these guys are taking, they're not just insuring against their own investments, they're taking out insurance against other people's investments. They're hedging against other people's. It's a very strange thing. So for example, what an equivalent is that you go and buy a car and I think to myself, I reckon Frank's going to crash that car. So I go to Susan and I say, hey, Susan, how do you want to make a bet with me that Frank's going to crash that car within the next 5 years? And if he does, you pay me the amount of the car. But every month, in order to take that action, I'll pay you $5. That's essentially what they're doing. It's a side bet on your personal economy. They're doing that with all sorts of companies. Now, if you make a side bet on sports in this country, it's illegal. But apparently, you can do it on Wall Street with companies. And that just seems kind of outrageous to me.
And is there a difference, again, in terms of the benefit to all of us, social benefit. If I'm the airline and I want to hedge my bet against a spike in oil prices, maybe what I'll do is buy a contract 5 years out, and that's good. And I, as a flyer, I'm happy you did that because if they do spike, my ticket price doesn't go up 3 years from now. I like that. But on the investment banks don't have a use value for the product. When they just play for pennies on the dollar up and down, does that really help us all, or is that just for the people who can afford to play their game?
Well, what it does is it provides liquidity. If you have people in the market and the investment banks, you know, buying and selling these contracts, it does provide liquidity. It means that if you need to get out of your contract, you can get out of it quickly and you can trade it around. So they're not actually you know, when somebody buys a contract, this futures contract for, you know, for 5,000 barrels of oil or, you know, 10,000 gallons of orange juice or whatever it is, they're not expecting that orange juice or that oil to appear on their doorstep in 3 years' time. You know, that's the derivative, because it's these things are derived from an underlying product, which is the oil or the orange juice. So they're just playing with paper. And that you could construe that as a problem. All they're doing is just throwing paper money around. And that's fair enough. But at the same time, like I say, it does provide that liquidity. So if people need to escape from the contract, they can do. It makes life a lot easier for them. But it also provides a very healthy market, you know, in terms of buying and selling this paper, which allows people to make money notionally and allows people like you and I to have to invest, not necessarily ourselves, but through the mutual funds in which we invest our retirement accounts.
Let's take a look at Bank of America right down the road. We've been talking a little bit about regulation. Federal government just took him to court, suing him for $1 billion in fraud. Tell us about that case.
Well, for a start, $1 billion sounds like a lot, but it's really a drop in the bucket as far as these guys are concerned. Not to them. But, you know, here's the thing. We have this situation where Bank of America bought Countrywide, thinking that it was the home lender.
It's a mortgage company, right?
And they thought this is going to be the greatest acquisition ever, right? It's going to be great. These guys make so many loans, they make so much money, they're making it hand over fist. We're going to get a piece of this. It's going to be great for us. Then, of course, they found that Countrywide was really involved in some very dodgy dealings, selling, you know, lending people money that they were never going to be able to pay back. It was very obvious now, you know, these liar loans, all the rest of it, and of course. The whole thing came tumbling down, and now Bank of America is left holding the bag, and it's very expensive for them. So they're kind of trying to wriggle out of this situation. But unfortunately, they bought, as we say in Ireland, a pig in a poke, and they're suffering for it.
If you're a bank, should you be buying pigs in a poke, or should you be looking at how did you make all this money? Because other people are in the business. In fact, we're in the home loan business, and we're noticing you're making a lot more money than I. My very first question would be, how are you doing that?
Right, you should be poking the pig pretty hard to see.
I wouldn't have to poke that hard. It was pretty clear that they're changing applications. They're lying on applications. They're pressuring people, and in many cases discriminating against minorities. Wouldn't it take me 10 minutes to figure that out if I was a banker, I'd think?
Well, you know, this is one of these things is, you know, you have these banks making these big acquisitions kind of at the drop of the hat. I mean, JP Morgan is in the same situation because of its acquisitions, and it's being sued as a result of that as well. And a lot of these banks are saying, well, you know, we're making these decisions very, very quickly. Well, frankly, you know, tough on you. You know,
it took 6 weeks to decide on my creditworthiness for the loan. Why did it take them a minute and a half on Countrywide?
I know. It just doesn't. That scale doesn't seem to make any difference. Doesn't make any difference, does it? But no, there's no doubt that you know they're in the firing line, and as they should be. I mean, the banks. It's interesting. You know, the banks have kind of appear to have gotten away scot free with this. You know, there doesn't seem to have been any repercussion. You know, people have not ended up in court. Nobody's gone to jail. I think there's a great resentment about that within the public. You know, no matter which side of the political divide you sit, and I think that this is part of that. You know, the government is saying, right, we've got to start squeezing these guys. We've got to start showing that, you know, there's no room for moral hazard in this system. You know, you can't just take a risk expecting the government to bail you out. So I think that's one of the reasons that they're putting the squeeze on Bank of America, and, you know, rightly so. I think, you know, we have to see some results of all of these investigations, otherwise people are just going to be worried it's going to happen again and again and again.
Paddy, great pleasure to have you here in our studio. Thank you very much.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Paddy Hirsch, senior producer of Marketplace Money, Public Radio's weekly personal finance program. His new book is called Man Versus Markets. Coming up next on The State of Things, a week left before the election, we're going to consider political polling. Who creates these polls and why do they matter? Stay tuned.